Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 14. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Fighting prevents the World Food Program from accessing some areas of Sudan.
We're looking at around 40% of the population not knowing where their next meal would come from. And the situation before was already extremely challenging in terms of food security.
Host nations face challenges welcoming Sudanese refugees. Ethiopia's Rights Commission says enforced disappearances are rising. John Frundi, Cameroon's longtime opposition leader, has died at age 81. Rwandan refugees in Malawi complained of being targeted and victimized.
The way the government is doing it, it means even genuine refugees stand at risk of being deported like that. They will not have the opportunity to defend themselves.
And Cameroonian officials complain against taboos to encourage civilians to donate blood as we commemorate World Blood Donor Day today, June 14. The stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Officials with the UN World Food Program in Sudan say it is impossible to access certain locations in the country due to intense fighting and fragile conditions. A WFP spokesperson in Sudan says the food agency is not able to reach people caught up in crossfire in Khartoum and West Darfur states. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
Lenny Kinsley, WFP's head of communications in Sudan, calls the humanitarian situation catastrophic as fighting between the army and the rapid support forces intensifies in and around the capital Khartoum, Al Obeid, and Al Janina of West Darfur State.
We're looking at around 40% of the population not knowing where their next meal would come from. And the situation before was already extremely challenging in terms of food security, mainly due to intercommunal violence, climate shocks, the economic crisis, and now with the ongoing conflict, it's just going to push more and more people into hunger.
In a report released today, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Sudan said nearly 1.9 million people have been displaced since the conflict began on April 15th. Some have fled to safer locations inside the country, while others have left Sudan. The report says humanitarian partners have reached 1.8 million people with life-saving assistance and protection services in April and May, despite insecurity and operational challenges. WFP says it has only managed to reach about 850,000 with emergency food assistance. Kinsley says it is difficult to deliver food aid during heavy fighting.
When we know where people need support and that they need it immediately, but when there is fighting going on and people can hardly step outside of their door, it makes it extremely difficult to move entire convoys of trucks with food assistance across the country to places where people need support.
Kinsley is calling on the international community to step up support for Sudan and urges both sides to silence guns so humanitarian assistance can be delivered to the vulnerable.
Both parties need to stop the fighting and put their actions where their words are and actually take concrete actions for a lasting and reliable ceasefire and to stop making the situation worse for the Sudanese civilians who are bearing the brunt of this conflict.
UN OCHA says despite the challenges, aid agencies continue to provide life-saving assistance and sustenance to those affected by the conflict, including the internally displaced. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
The United Nations expects close to 1 million people to flee Sudan by October this year, most of them to neighboring countries like the Central African Republic, Chad, Egypt, Ethiopia, and South Sudan. But most of those nations have their own problems with people displaced by conflict who face food insecurity and instability. Henry Wilkins reports from Barata, Chad, on what Sudanese refugees will face in their host communities.
16-year-old Saeed Adam Mohammed says one morning in May he rode his bike down to this patch of ground on the outskirts of Barota, a Chadian town about 5 kilometres from the Sudan border. As he rode past the makeshift shelters, he could see the people were in need of help. He says people escaped and came to Chad, but there is no food or drinking water, no clothing. The refugees lost all of their belongings. Some 425,000 refugees have now fled to neighbouring countries because of Sudan's civil war. But many of their host countries face their own conflicts and are struggling to feed their own people amid skyrocketing food prices and inflation. Experts and aid groups say Sudanese refugees face far from certain futures in host countries, including the Central African Republic, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Egypt. The mayor of Barota, Toko Bahat, says the community has done what it can to welcome the refugees. He says the people in Barota are from a mix of places like Konga and Porto, so they know one another. He adds they are like siblings since they come from the same families and tribes, so there is no problem in them living together. Similarly, in South Sudan, many of those fleeing Sudan are South Sudanese returnees. However, two-thirds of South Sudan's population already faces food insecurity and instability in Renk, where many refugees have arrived. Gemma Snowden is a spokesperson for the UN's World Food Programme in South Sudan.
The difference with South Sudan compared to perhaps Chad or Egypt is that the majority of people who are coming across the border are returnees. Communities are quite welcoming, and of course we hope that continues. The pressure that this is putting on markets, on the humanitarian response, is definitely going to be difficult for humanitarian agencies and the government.
Most Sudanese refugees, more than 170,000, have fled to Egypt in recent weeks. Egypt's currency has been devalued by 50% against the dollar in the last year, while food prices have risen by 60%. The Central African Republic, where around 14,000 refugees have arrived, has been embroiled in a civil war for more than 10 years, and security is dire. Ethiopia, where thousands of refugees have fled, is recovering from a civil war that ended in November. Eritrea has been accused of forcibly turning away refugees attempting to flee Sudan's fighting. On a visit to Egypt in late May, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees commended Egypt for helping Sudan's refugees, but said, "We urgently need to mobilise more resources to help them to maintain this generosity." Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Barota, Chad.
Rwandan refugees and asylum seekers in Malawi say they fear being deported or losing their right to stay in the country following steps by the government to apprehend refugees wanted in their home countries on various charges. The government said last week it has received a request from Rwanda to help track down 55 so-called warlords who are hiding in Malawi. Rwandan refugees say officials need to verify the allegations before acting. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The Rwandan refugees expressed their fears in a statement following the deportation Monday of a Rwandan genocide suspect, Vincent Gendahimana Kanyoni, who was indicted in 2019. In a statement, a refugee group called Concerned Rwandan Refugees said Malawi should be cautious with requests from the Rwandan government. The group said Rwanda might be playing what it called the genocide card to target political opponents in exile. Odette Nalikondo is the representative of Rwandan refugees in Malawi. Nalikondo told VOA she believes Kanyoni's deportation was based on wrong information, saying the suspect never worked as a soldier in Rwanda and never had any military training there. Nalikondo says she doubts Rwanda's claims that 44 former Rwandan generals are hiding in Malawi. She says if it is true that the Rwandan army generals were hiding, they could not have been staying in Zaleka refugee camp up to this time. She says they could have left long ago for various engagements elsewhere. She adds an army general is a dangerous person. I wonder why Malawi is behaving this way. Nalikondo says she believes that Rwanda is using genocide-related accusations to target political opponents living abroad. She says many Rwandan refugees fear being picked up and deported without even taken to court to defend themselves, as was the case with Kanyoni. She says people are living in fear now of what has happened. They could have taken him to court before deporting him. What happened, she says, is a typical kidnapping. She adds, I think Malawi will be answerable to what is happening. Narikundo says Malawi should verify any information from Rwanda with the group known as the Government of Rwanda's in Exile, based in France, before rushing to taking any action. Patrick Porter is a spokesperson for the Ministry of Homeland Security in Malawi. He told VOA that Malawi is a sovereign state doing everything according to its laws.
But we have a working relationship with different countries, especially our neighbors. That includes Rwanda, Burundi, just like we do with Zambia, Mozambique, and Tanzania. So in terms of issues of security, we work hand in hand with these governments.
Bota, however, declined to take more questions, citing the sensitivity around the issue.
That's all I can say on the matter. The other issues concerning this are very sensitive, maybe security issues. So it will be not right for me to go into those details.
Michael Kaias is the executive director for the Center for Human Rights and Rehabilitation in Malawi. He shares the concerns of the Rwandan refugees.
Because the way the government is doing it, it means even genuine refugees stand at risk of being deported like that. They will not have the opportunity to defend themselves. You know, police or immigration police cannot make that determination. They are not a court on themselves.
Last month, Malawi started revoking citizenship of refugees and asylum seekers who officials say obtained their status fraudulently. Some 400 people, mainly from Burundi and Rwanda, have had their Malawian citizenships revoked, and plans are underway to deport them. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta, Malawi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 14. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission has called for an end to what it calls a rising trend of enforced disappearances in the country. The government has yet to respond to the commission's report, which says at least 12 people have been arrested or abducted under unclear circumstances. Maya Misikoro reports from Addis Ababa.
In a report released June 5, the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission said the enforced disappearances have happened across Amhara and Oromia regions, as well as in the capital, Addis Ababa. Imad Abdul Fattah, regional director for the commission, says the disappearances seem to be related to the war in the northern Tigray region, which ended last year following an African Union-brokered peace deal and ethnic conflicts elsewhere. He says, primarily, these became more common in the aftermath of the conflicts in the country. These incidents are connected to the conflict in one way or the other. So this 1 year or a half, at most not more than 2 years, since this became widespread. The commission's report says victims of enforced disappearances include members of the Ethiopian National Defense Force, as well as opposition political parties. The Oromo Federalist Congress, an opposition political party, says four of its members have gone missing over the past few years. Party chief Marara Gudina says attempts to locate them have failed. He says, it looks to me like the government has decided to rule by force. And we have been meeting and talking with government officials, but they have not taken any meaningful steps. The OFC Secretary General Teruna Gemta says the party has confirmed the death of Melese Chala, a local-level party official who was missing for more than 2 years. He says, it looks to me like the government has decided to rule by force. And we have been meeting and talking with government officials, but they have not taken any meaningful steps. Such actions hurt the democratic process and push people to take up arms instead, says Marara. He says if the government is narrowing and stifling the political playground, those who have the capacity and the force will think, let me go into the forest and try my luck, instead of being imprisoned and wasting away. Victims of these enforced disappearances sometimes show up weeks or months later still alive, but in locations far from where they were last seen and often in poor physical condition, according to the report. The government-established commission said it is investigating allegations that some of the victims were tortured. The Rights Commission has called for the Ethiopian government to adopt and ratify the International Convention for the Protection of All Persons from Enforced Disappearance in order to ensure the protection of civilians. Maya Musikir for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
John Frundi, Cameroon's longtime opposition leader, has died at age 81. He founded the Social Democratic Front SDF party in 1990 and led it until his death. His party says Frundi passed away on Monday this week in Yaoundé following a prolonged illness. He challenged President Paul Biya, Africa's oldest and second longest serving president, in election after election, but always came up short. The late Frundi was sometimes criticized by some in his party for holding on to the party's leadership despite his age. Ellis Smith is a journalist and former secretary of the Anglophone General Conference. From Douala, he tells me the late Frundi was a true patriot who believed in a united Cameroon.
Frundi has been sick for some time, according to his relative. And I think even last year when I met him during his birthday, he complained to me that he's not feeling well and that he's already old. It was time for a new generation to take over from the fight that he has been fighting for almost 30 years.
He was the leader of the main opposition. What can you tell us in terms of his political legacy?
Well, about his political legacy, that is a man who had an ideology. He was firm and he stood for the truth. And social justice is something that we don't find today in our political landscape in Cameroon.
Of course, there had been this complaint that he was the sole leader and not much was done to at least expand the party or give the party to a younger generation.
Well, I tend to differ on that because already his vice chair, Joshua Osi, is a younger person. And he was planning that after the convention, it was to bring up a new generation of leaders. He told me that personally that he is mindful that he and his generation at the helms of affairs of the SDF had committed a number of errors because they are human beings, but that he felt that it was time to pass the baton down to a new generation of Cameroonians from all walks of life, especially from minority groups, in order to give them an opportunity at the management of the country, minority groups, women and youth.
I was just reading someone wrote on social media that Frundi was a strong united Cameroonian, or he was in favor of uniting Cameroon. In the wake of the Abazonia uprising, what do you think was his position on the current situation?
His position was clear. He was for a united Cameroon. And he has also been, and he stood till he left this world, for a federal Cameroon, because that was the foundation onto which the modern Cameroon was created in 1961. His position for a united and strong Cameroon did not endear him into the minds of those who are promoting the separation of Cameroon, that is, those who refer to themselves as Ambazonia. But he was a tolerant fellow. He never considered Ambazonians as enemies. His problem with Ambazonians was that the Ambazonians were not tolerant. He accepted them, he supported them, but the Ambazonians were not in support of him simply because they felt that he did not support their separatist stand. And Frundi told me he was a legalist. He voted for reunification of Cameroon. He voted for a Federal Republic of Cameroon. And he will stand for a united Federal Cameroon.
In a world or two, how do you think Frundi will be remembered?
Frundi will be remembered as a peace-loving Cameroonian and as a tolerant person who fought for equality and pro-democracy in Cameroon.
Ellis Smith is a journalist and former secretary of the Anglophone General Conference in Cameroon. He was speaking with us from Douala. Food banks in Cameroon are usually closed to empty due to widely held taboos against blood donations. Officials in the Central African country are trying to convince people to move past those taboos amid an increased demand for blood and blood products in hospitals and on the front lines where soldiers are fighting separatists and Boko Haram militants. Moki Edwin Kizika reports from the capital Yaoundé as Cameroon mobilizes for World Blood Donor Day today, Wednesday, June 4th.
A woman tells nurses at the Yaoundé military hospital that he has not found anyone to donate blood to save the life of her 2-year-old son. Hospital workers say the 34-year-old fruit seller's blood is infected and cannot be transfused to her son. Medical staff members have requested blood from government hospitals to save the child's life, the hospital says, adding that the blood bank at the military hospital is empty. Celestine Ayangma is the head of the laboratory that is in charge of the hospital's blood bank. Ayangma says since January 2023, the Yaoundé Military Hospital is able to provide only 6 of the 20 units of blood it needs every day. Ayangma says patients eventually die when they do not have relatives, friends or well-wishers to donate the blood that the patients need. By midday on Tuesday, the baby was still waiting for blood. Cameroon's Public Health Ministry reports that in 2022, hospitals in the Central African state were able to collect a little more than 120,000 pints of blood from voluntary donors, family members, and friends of sick patients. But each year, Cameroon needs at least 600,000 pints of blood for both private and government-owned hospitals. The government says blood needs in Cameroon are increasing due to the separatist conflicts in the country's western regions and fighting with Boko Haram militants on the northern border with Nigeria. This year, government officials, health workers, and aid agencies took to the streets ahead of World Blood Donor Day on June 14, trying to convince people to donate blood and save lives. Ruth Abeng of the Cameroon Medical Council, an association of Cameroonian doctors, is taking part in the campaign.
Les gens viennent donner parce qu'ils sont obligés de donner pour leurs proches.
She says there are very few voluntary blood donors in Cameroon. Abeng says some people are compelled to donate blood only when they see their sick relatives and friends who are in need of blood dying. She says it is disheartening to see patients dying because some of their relatives believe that blood donation is mystical. Some Cameroonians believe that if they give blood, the recipients will receive any good luck and success they have had in life. Others say God will punish them if they donate blood to an evil person. The government says such beliefs are unfounded and people should not be afraid to donate blood. The Ministry of Health also says donated blood is not sold as some people erroneously believe. Blood that is donated is stored in banks and transfused to people in need, the government says. Hospitals say patients pay a fee of about $50 for the hospital to test the blood and make sure it is safe to use. The government gives donors about $10 in a bid to encourage more donations. Cameroon says it expects to raise about 20,000 pints of blood by June 14. Hospitals say the amount will not be enough to meet the country's needs, but that it will reduce pain and dying. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And that's it for this Wednesday, June 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Butting, Washington, wishing that you will have a very good Wednesday.